It is Avi's turn to come to a stop for a while and make swallowing noises. "Sorry, I would have mentioned it earlier," Randy says, "but I didn't know it was relevant until now."
"How did Amy become aware of this?"
"Night before last, before she climbed on the plane at SeaTac, I helped her check her email. Her father sent her a message saying that a certain number of intact Kriegsmarine dinner plates had been found on the submarine. This was a prearranged code for gold bars."
"You said full of fucking gold bars. Could you translate that into an actual number, like in terms of dollars?"
"Avi, who gives a shit? I think we can agree that if the same thing is discovered by Andrew Loeb, we're finished."
"Wow,"
Avi says.
"So, in this, a hypothetical person who is not above tampering with evidence would certainly have a strong motive."
"It is make or break," Randy agrees. They stop conversing for a while because they now have to dodge cars across the Pacific Coast Highway, and there is this unspoken agreement between them that not getting hit by speeding vehicles merits one's full attention. They end up running across the last couple of lanes in order to exploit a fortuitous break in the northbound traffic. Then neither of them especially feels like dropping back to a walk, so they run all the way across the parking lot of the neighborhood grocery store and into the wooded creek valley, where Avi has his house. They are back at the house directly, and then Avi points significantly at the ceiling, which is his way of saying that they had better assume the house is bugged now. Avi walks over to his answering machine, which is blinking, and ejects the incoming message tape. He shoves it in his pocket and strides across the house's living room, ignoring frosty glares from one of his Israeli nannies, who doesn't like him to wear shoes inside the house. Avi scoops a brightly colored plastic box off the floor. It has a handle and rounded corners and big bright buttons and a microphone trailing behind it on a coiled yellow cord. Avi continues through the patio doors without breaking stride, the microphone bouncing up and down behind him on its helical cord. Randy follows him outside, across a strip of dead grass and into a grove of cypress trees. They keep walking until they have dropped into a little dell that shields them from view of the street. Then Avi squats down and ejects a Rafi tape from the little kid tape recorder and shoves in his incoming message tape, rewinds it, and plays it.
"Hi, Avi. This is Dave, calling from Norvis Ordo Seclorum Systems. I'm the, president here, you might remember. You have this computer in our wiring closet. Well, we just, like, got some visitors here, like, guys in suits, and they said that they wanted to see that computer, and, like, if we handed it over to them right away, they would be totally cool about it. But if we didn't, they'd come back with a subpoena and with cops and turn the place inside out and just take it. So now we're playing stupid. Please call me."
"The machine said there were two messages," Avi says.
"Hi, Avi. This is Dave again. Playing stupid didn't work, and so now we told them to fuck off. The head suit is very mad at us. He called me out. We had a really tense discussion in the McDonald's across the street. He says that I am being stupid, that when they come and turn the place upside down looking for Tombstone, that it will totally fuck up Ordo's corporate operations and inflict major losses on our shareholders. He said that this would probably be grounds for a minority shareholder lawsuit against me and that he'd be happy to file that lawsuit. I haven't told him yet that Ordo has only 5 shareholders and that all of us work here. The manager of the McDonald's asked us to leave because we were disrupting some children's happy meals. I acted scared and told him that I would go in and look at Tombstone and see what would be involved in removing it. Instead, I'm calling you. Hal and Rick and Carrie are uploading the entire contents of her own system to a remote location so that when these cops come and rip everything out, nothing will be lost. Please call me. Goodbye."
"Gosh," Randy says. "I feel like shit for having inflicted all of this on Dave and his crew."
"It'll be great publicity for them," Avi says. "I'm sure Dave has 6 television crews poised in the McDonald's at this moment, stoking themselves to the rim of insanity on 32-ounce coffees."
"Well, what do you think we should do?"
"It is only fitting and proper that I should go there," Avi says.
"You know, we could just fess up. Tell the dentist about the 10% handshake deal."
"Randy, get this through your head. The dentist doesn't give a shit about the submarine. The dentist doesn't give a shit about the submarine.
The dentist doesn't give a shit about the submarine,
Randy says. So, I am going to replace this cassette, Avi says, popping the tape out of the machine, and start driving really, really fast.
Well, I'm going to do what my conscience tells me to do,
Randy says. The most cigarettes, Avi says.
I'm not going to do it from here,
Randy says.
I'm going to do it from the Sultanate of Kinakuta.
Christmas, 1944. Goto Dango has pointed Wing out to Lieutenant Mori and Mori's guard troops and made it clear that they are not to run their bayonets through Wing's torso and wiggle the blades around in his vitals unless there is some exceptionally good reason, such as suppressing all-out rebellion. The same qualities that make Wing valuable to Goto Dango make him the most likely leader of any organized breakout attempt. As soon as the general and his aide have departed from Boondock, Goto Dango goes and finds Wing, who is supervising the boring of the diagonal shaft towards Lake Yamamoto. He is one of those lead-by-example types, and so he is way up at the rock face, working a drill, at the end of a few hundred meters of tunnel so narrow that it has to be negotiated on hands and knees. Goto Dango has to present himself at the Golgotha end of the tunnel and send a messenger crawling up into it, wearing a rusty helmet to protect himself from the shattered stone that drizzles down from the rock face. Wing appears 15 minutes later, black from the rock dust that has condensed onto his sweaty skin, red where the skin has been abraded or slashed by stone. He devotes a few minutes to methodically hawking dust up out of his lungs. Every so often he rolls his tongue like a pea shooter and fires a jet of phlegm against the wall and clinically observes it run down the stone. Goto Dango stands by politely. These Chinese have an entire medical belief system centering on phlegm, and working in the mines gives them a lot to talk about.
Ventilation not good,
Goto Dango says. Whorehouse Shanghainese has not equipped him with certain technical terms like ventilation, so Wing has taught him the vocabulary. Wing grimaces.
I want to finish tunnel. I do not want to sink more ventilation shaft. Waste of time.
The only way to keep the workers at the rock face from suffocating is by sinking vertical air shafts from the surface down to the diagonal shaft at intervals. They have devoted as much effort to these as they have to the diagonal itself. And we're hoping they'd never have to dig another.
How much farther?
Goto Dango asks, as Wing finishes another paroxysm. Wing looks thoughtfully at the ceiling. He has Golgotha mapped out in his head better than its designer does.
50 meter.
The designer cannot help grinning.
Is that all? Excellent.
We go fast now,
Wing says proudly, his teeth gleaming for a moment in the lamplight. Then he seems to remember that he is a slave laborer in a death camp, and the teeth disappear.
We can go faster if we dig in straight line.
Wing is alluding to the fact that the tunnel to Lake Yamamoto is laid out in blueprints as a diagonal. But Goto Dango, without changing the blueprints, has ordered that it actually be dug with bends. These bends increase the length of the tunnel by quite a bit. Furthermore, the rubble tends to pile up in the flatter western section and must be raked along by hand. The only people who know about the existence of these bends are him, Wing, and Wing's crew. The only person who understands the true reason for their existence is Goto Dango.
Do not dig in a straight line. Keep digging, as I said.
Yes.
Also, you will need a new ventilation shaft.
More ventilation shaft? No!
Wing protests. The ventilation shafts, shown on the plans, awkward zigzags and all, are bad enough. But Goto Dango has several times told Wing and his crew to begin work on some additional ventilation shafts before changing his mind and telling them to abandon the work.
These new ventilation shafts will be dug from the top down,
says Goto Dango.
No,
says Wing, still completely flabbergasted. This is utter madness, in that if you dig a vertical shaft from the top downwards,
you have to haul the rubble up out of the hole. If you do it the other way, the rubble falls down and can be easily disposed of.
You will get new helpers, Filipino workers.
Wing looks stunned. He is even more cut off from the world than Gododengo. He must infer the progress of the war from maddeningly oblique hints. He and his workers fit the crazily scattered evidence at their disposal into elaborate theories. These theories are all so wildly wrong that Gododengo would laugh out loud at them, if not for the fact that he is sympathetic. Neither he nor Captain Noda knew that MacArthur had landed on Leyte, or that the Imperial Navy had been crushed until the General told them. One thing that Wing and his men have got right is that Boondock employs imported labor in order to ensure secrecy. If any of the Chinese workers do manage to escape, they will find themselves on an island far from home among people who do not speak their language and who do not especially like them. The fact that Filipino workers will soon be arriving give them a lot to think about. They will be up all night whispering to each other, trying to reconstruct their theories.
"We don't need new workers. We are almost done,"
Wing says, his pride hurt again. Gododengo taps himself on both shoulders with both index fingers, suggesting epaulets. It takes Wing only an instant to realize that he's talking about the General, and then a profoundly conspiratorial look comes over his face and he takes half a step closer.
"Orders,"
Gododengo says.
"We dig lots of ventilation shafts now."
Wing was not a miner when he arrived at Boondock, but he is now. He is baffled, as he should be.
"Ventilation shafts? To where?"
"To nowhere,"
Gododengo says. Wing's face is still blank. He thinks Gododengo's bad Shanghainese is preventing understanding, but Gododengo knows that Wing will figure it out soon, some night during the bad, fretful moments that always come just before sleep. And then he will lead the rebellion, and Lieutenant Maury's men will be ready for it. They will open fire with their mortars. They will detonate the mines, use the machine guns, sweeping across their carefully plotted interlocking fields of fire. None of them will survive. Gododengo doesn't want that, so he reaches out and slaps Wing on the shoulder.
"I will give you instructions. We will make a special shaft."
Then he turns around and leaves. He has surveying to do. He knows that Wing will put it all together in time to save himself. Filipino prisoners arrive, in columns that have degenerated into ragged skeins, shuffling on bare feet, leaving a wet red trail up the road. They are prodded onwards by the boots and bayonets of Nipponese army troops, who look almost as wretched. When Gododengo sees them staggering into the camp, he realizes that they must have been on their feet continuously since the order was given by the General 2 days ago. The General promised 500 new workers. Slightly fewer than 300 actually arrive, and from the fact that none of them is being carried on stretchers, a statistical impossibility given their average physical condition, Gododengo assumes that the other 200 must have stumbled or passed out en route and been executed where they hit the ground. Boondock is eerily well-stocked with fuel and rations, and he sees to it that the prisoners and the army troops alike are well-fed and given a day of rest. Then he puts them to work. Gododengo has been commanding men long enough now that he picks out the good ones right away. There is a toothless, pop-eyed character named Rodolfo with iron-gray hair and a big cyst on his cheek, arms that are too long, hands like grappling hooks, and splay-toed feet that remind him of the natives he lived with on New Guinea. His eyes are no particular color. They seem to have been put together from shards of other people's eyes, scintillas of gray, blue, hazel, and black, all sintered together. Rodolfo is self-conscious about his lack of teeth and always holds one of his sprawling, prehensile paws over his mouth when he speaks. Whenever Gododengo or another authority figure comes nearby, all of the young Filipino men avert their gaze and look significantly at Rodolfo, who steps forward, covers his mouth, and fixes his weird, alarming stare upon the visitor.
Form your men into half a dozen squads and give each squad a name and a leader. Make sure each man knows the name of his squad and of his leader,
Gododengo says rather loudly. At least some of the other Filipinos must speak English. Then he bends closer and says quietly,
Keep a few of the best and strongest men for yourself.
Rodolfo blinks, stiffens, steps back, removes his hand from his mouth, and uses it to snap out a salute. His hand is like an awning that throws a shadow over his entire face and chest. It is obvious that he has learned to salute from Americans. He turns on his heel.
Rodolfo!
Rodolfo turns around again, looking so irritated that Gododengo must stifle a laugh.
MacArthur is on Leyte.
Rodolfo's chest inflates like a weather balloon, and he gains about 3 inches in height, but the expression on his face does not change. The news ramifies through the Filipino camp like lightning seeking the ground. The tactic has the desired effect of giving the Filipinos a reason to live again. They suddenly display great energy and verve. A supply of badly worn drills and air compressors has arrived on Carabao-drawn carts, evidently brought in from one of the other boondock-like sites around Luzon. The Filipinos, experts at internal combustion, cannibalize some compressors to fix others. Meanwhile, the drills are passed around to Rodolfo's squads, who drag them up onto the top of the ridge between the rivers and begin sinking the new ventilation shafts, while Wing's Chinese men put the last touches on the Golgotha complex below. The carts that brought in the equipment were simply grabbed off the roads by the Nipponese army, along with their drivers, mostly farm boys, and pressed into service on the spot. The farm boys can never leave Boondock, of course. The weaker Carabaos are slaughtered for meat. The stronger ones put to work on Golgotha, and the drivers are assimilated into the workforce. One of these is a boy named Juan, with a big round head and a distinctly Chinese cast to his features. He turns out to be trilingual. He can communicate in a sort of pigeon with Wing and the other Chinese, frequently by using a finger to draw Chinese characters on the palm of his hand. Juan is small, healthy, and has a kind of wary agility that Gododengo thinks may be useful in what is to come, and so he becomes one of the special crew. The submerged plumbing in Lake Yamamoto needs to be inspected. Gododengo has Rodolfo ask around and see if there are any men among them who have worked as pearl divers. He quickly finds one, a lithe, frail-looking fellow from Palawan, named Augustine. Augustine is weak from dysentery, but he seems to perk up around water and, after a couple of days' rest, is diving down to the bottom of Lake Yamamoto with no trouble. He becomes another of Rodolfo's picked men. There are really too many Filipinos for the number of tools and holes that they have available, and so the work goes quickly at first, as fresh men are quickly rotated through by the squad leaders. Then, one night at about 2 in the morning, an unfamiliar sound reverberates through the jungle, filtering up from the lowlands where the Tojo River meanders through cane fields and rice paddies. It is the sound of vehicles, masses of them. Since the Nipponese have been out of fuel for months, Gododengo's first thought is that it must be MacArthur. He throws on a uniform and runs down to Boondock's main gate along with the other officers. Dozens of trucks and a few automobiles are queued up there, engines running, headlights off. When he hears a Nipponese voice coming from the lead car, his heart sinks. He long ago stopped feeling bad about wanting to be rescued by General Douglas MacArthur. Many soldiers ride atop the trucks. When the sun rises, Gododengo savors the novel and curious sight of fresh, healthy, well-fed Nipponese men. They are armed with light and heavy machine guns. They look like Nipponese soldiers did way back in 1937, when they were rolling across northern China. It gives Gododengo a strange feeling of nostalgia to remember a day when a terrible defeat was not imminent, when they were not going to lose everything horribly. A lump actually gathers in his throat, and his nose begins to run. Then he snaps out of it, realizing that the big day has finally arrived. The part of him that is still a loyal soldier of the Emperor has a duty to see that the vital war material, which has just arrived, is stored away in the big vault of Golgotha. The part of him that isn't a loyal soldier anymore still has a lot to accomplish. In war, no matter how much you plan and prepare and practice, when the big day actually arrives, you still can't find your ass with both hands. This day is no exception. But after a few hours of chaos, things get straightened out, people learn their roles. The heavier trucks cannot make it up the rough road that Goto Dengo's had built up the stream bed of the Toja River, but a couple of the small ones can, and these become the shuttles. So the big trucks pull one by one into a heavily fenced and guarded area, well sheltered from MacArthur's observation planes, that was built months ago. Filipinos swarm into these trucks and unload crates, which are small but evidently quite heavy. Meanwhile, the smaller trucks shuttle the crates up the Toja River Road to the entrance of Golgotha, where they are unloaded onto handcars and rolled into the tunnel to the main vault. As per the instructions handed down from on high, Goto Dengo sees to it that every 20th crate is diverted to the Fool's Chamber. The unloading proceeds automatically from there, and Goto Dengo devotes most of these days to supervising the final stages of the digging. The new ventilation shafts are proceeding on schedule, and he only needs to check them once a day. The diagonal is now only a few meters away from the bottom of Lake Yamamoto. Groundwater has begun to seep through small cracks in the bedrock and trickle down the diagonal into Golgotha, where it collects in a sump that drains into the Tojo. Another few meters of cutting, and they will break through into the short stub tunnel that Wing and his men created many months ago, digging downwards from what later became the bottom of the lake. Wing himself is otherwise engaged these days. He and Rodolfo and their special crew are completing final preparations. Rodolfo and company are digging down from the top of the ridge, cutting what looks like just another vertical ventilation shaft. Wing and company are directly below, engaged in a complicated subterranean plumbing project. Goto Dengo has entirely lost track of what day it is. About 4 days after the trucks come, though, he gets a clue. The Filipinos spontaneously break into song over their evening rice bowls. Goto Dengo recognizes the tune vaguely. He occasionally heard the American Marines singing it in Shanghai. What child is this who laid to rest on Mary's lap is sleeping? The Filipinos sing that and other songs in English and Spanish and Latin all evening long. After they get their lungs unlimbered, they sing astonishingly well, occasionally breaking into two- and three-part harmony. At first, Lieutenant Maury's guards get itchy trigger fingers, thinking it's some kind of a signal for a mass breakout. Goto Dengo doesn't want to see his work cut short by a massacre, and so he explains to them that it is a religious thing, a peaceful celebration. That night, another midnight truck convoy arrives, and the workers are rousted to unload it. They work cheerfully, singing Christmas carols and making jokes about Santa Claus. The whole camp stays up well past sunrise unloading trucks. Boondock has gradually become a nocturnal place anyway, to avoid the gaze of observation planes. Goto Dengo is just thinking of hitting the sack when a fusillade of sharp crackling noises breaks out above the camp on the Toja River. Ammunition being in short supply, hardly anyone actually fires guns anymore, and he almost doesn't recognize the sound of the Nambu. Then he jumps onto the running board of a truck and tells the driver to head upstream. The shooting has died down as suddenly as it started. Beneath the bald tires of the truck, the river is turned opaque and bright red. About 2 dozen corpses lie in the water before the entrance to Golgotha. Nipponese soldiers stand around them, up to their calves in the red water, their weapons slung from their shoulders. A sergeant is going around with a bayonet, stirring the guts of the Filipinos who are still moving.
"What is going on?"
Goto Dengo says. No one answers. But no one shoots him either. He will be allowed to figure it out himself. The workers had clearly been unloading another small truck, which is still parked there at the head of the road. Resting beneath its tailgate is a wooden crate that was apparently dropped. Its heavy contents have exploded the crate and spilled across the uneven conglomerate of river rocks, poured concrete, and mine tailings that make up the riverbed here. Goto Dengo sloshes up to it and looks. He sees it clearly enough,
but he can't somehow absorb the knowledge until he feels it in his hands. He bends down, wraps his fingers around a cold brick on the bottom of the river, and heaves it up out of the water. It is a glossy ingot of yellow metal, incredibly heavy, stamped with words in English, Bank of Singapore. There is a scuffle behind him. The sergeant stands at the ready as two of his men jerk the Filipino driver out of the cab of his truck that Gotodengo rode in on. Calmly, looking almost bored, the sergeant bayonets the driver. The men drop him in the red water and he disappears.
Merry Christmas!
One of the soldiers cracks. Everyone laughs, except for Gotodengo. Pulse. As Avi walks back through his house, he utters something biblical-sounding in Hebrew that causes his kids to burst into tears and his nannies to rise from the kid mat and begin shoving stuff into bags. Deborah emerges from a back room where she's been sleeping off some morning sickness. She and Avi embrace tenderly in the hallway, and Randy begins to feel like a fleck of debris lodged in someone's eye. So he heads straight for an exit, goes out to his car, and starts driving. He winds through the hills over the San Andreas Fault to Skyline, and then heads south. 10 minutes later, Avi's car howls past him in the left lane, doing 90 or 100. Randy barely has time to read the bumper sticker. Mean people suck. Randy's looking for a totally anonymous location where he can patch into the internet. A hotel doesn't work because a hotel keeps good records of outgoing telephone calls. What he should really do is use this packet radio interface he has for his laptop, but even that requires a place to sit down and work undisturbed for a while. Which gets him thinking in terms of a fast food joint, not to be found in the mid-peninsular wasteland. By the time he has reached the northern skirts of the valley, Menlo Park and Palo Alto, he has decided, fuck it, he'll just go to the scene of the action. Maybe he could be of some use there. So he gets off at the El Monte exit and heads into the business district of Los Altos, a pretty typical mid-20th century American downtown gradually being metabolized by franchises. A major street intersects at something other than a 90-degree angle, a smaller commercial street, defining two smaller acute-angle lots and two larger obtuse-angle lots. On one side of the major street, the obtuse-angle lot is occupied by a two-story office building, home of Ordo's offices and Tombstone. The acute-angle lot is occupied by the McDonald's. On the opposite side of the major street, the acute-angle lot is occupied by, weirdly enough, a 24 Jam, the only one Randy has ever seen in the Western Hemisphere. The obtuse-angle lot is occupied by a park-and-lock, where you can park for the old-fashioned purpose of wandering around the business district from store to store. The parking lot of the McDonald's is full, and so Randy pulls through its drive-through window, chooses N, where N is a random number between 1 and 6, and asks for value meal N with supersized fries. This having been secured, he guns the Acura directly across the big street into the parking lot, just in time to see its last available space being seized by a minivan bearing the logo of a San Jose television station. Randy is not planning to stray far from his car, so he just blocks in another car. But as he is setting the parking brake, he notices movement inside it and, with a bit of further attention, realizes he is watching a man with long hair and a beard methodically ramming shells into a pump shotgun. The man catches sight of Randy in his rearview mirror and turns around with a scrupulously polite, "Pardon me, sir, but you seem to have blocked me in," look. Randy recognizes him as Mike or Mark, a graphics card hacker who farms ostriches in Gilroy, quirky hobbies being de rigueur in the high-tech world. He moves the Acura, blocking in what looks like an abandoned van from the Starsky and Hutch epoch. Randy climbs up on the roof of his car with his laptop and his value meal N. Until recently, he would never have sat on top of his Acura because his considerable mass would dimple the sheet metal. But after Amy rammed it with the truck, Randy became much less anal and now sees it as a tool to be used until it is just a moraine of rusted shards. He happens to have a 12-volt adapter for the laptop, so he runs that down into a cigarette lighter socket. Finally, he's settled. and gets a chance to take a good look around. The parking lot of Novus Ordo Seclorum's office building is filled with cop cars and BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes that Randy assumes belong to lawyers. Avi's Range Rover is parked jauntily on top of some landscaping, and a few TV camera crews have set up as well. In front of the building's main entrance, a lot of people are jammed into the smallest possible space, screaming at each other. They are surrounded by ring after concentric ring of cops, media, and law firm minions, collectively what Tolkien would call men, and a few non- or post-human creatures imbued with peculiar physiognomies and vaguely magical powers. Dwarves, steady, productive, surly, and elves, brilliant in a more ethereal way. Randy, a dwarf, has begun to realize that his grandfather may have been an elf. Avi is a man with a strong elvish glow about him. Somewhere in the center of this whole thing, presumably, is Gollum. There is a little window on the screen of Randy's laptop showing a cheesy 1940s newsreel-style animation of a radio tower with zigzaggy conceptual radio waves radiating outwards from it over the whole Earth, which is shown ludicrously not to scale in this rendering. The diameter of the Earth is about equal to the height of the radio tower. That these Jovian info bolts are visible and moving is a visual cue that his radio adapter has managed to patch itself into the packet radio network. Randy opens a terminal window and types telnetlaundry.org. And in a few seconds, bang, he gets a login prompt. Randy now has another look at the animated window and notes with approval that the info bolts have been replaced with gouts of question marks. This means that his computer has recognized laundry.org as a swan machine, running the secure wide area network protocol, which means that every packet going back and forth between Randy's laptop and laundry.org is encrypted. Definitely a good idea when you are about to do something illegal over the radio. Mike, or Mark, gets out of his car, cutting a dramatic figure in a long black western-style coat, a look rather spoiled by the t-shirt he's got on underneath it, black with a fat red question mark in the middle. He hitches the strap of his shotgun up onto his shoulder and leans into his back door to retrieve a large black cowboy hat, which he places on the roof of his car. He thrusts his elbows into the air and gathers his long hair back behind his ears, staring up at the sky, and then clamps the cowboy hat down on his head. Tied loosely around his neck is a black bandana with a question mark pattern, which he now pulls up over the bridge of his nose, so that just an eye slit shows between it and the cowboy hat. Randy would be really alarmed if it weren't for the fact that several of his friends, such as John Cantrell, often go around looking this way. Mike, or Mark, strides across the parking lot, tracked carefully by a panning cameraman, and jogs across the street to the 24 jam. Randy logs onto laundry.org using SSH, Secure Shell, a way of further encrypting communications between two computers. Laundry.org is an anonymizing service. All packets routed through it to another computer are stripped of identifying information first, so that anyone down the line who intercepts one of those packets has no way of knowing where it originated. Once he's patched into the anonymizer, Randy types telnetcrypt.kk and hits the return key and then actually, literally, prays. The crypt is still going through its shakedown period, which indeed is the only reason that all of Tombstone's contents have not been moved onto it yet. In the lot of the 24 jam, Mike or Mark has joined three other elvish-looking sorts in black cowboy hats and bandanas, whom Randy can identify based on the length and color of their ponytails and beards. There's Stu, a Berkeley grad student who is somehow mixed up in Abby's Heap project, and Phil, who invented a major programming language a couple of years ago and goes helicopter skiing in his spare time, and Craig, who knows everything there is to know about encrypted credit card transactions on the net, and is a devotee of traditional Nipponese archery. Some of these guys are wearing long coats and some aren't. There is a lot of secret admirers' iconography, t-shirts bearing the number 56, which is a code for Yamamoto, or just pictures of Yamamoto himself, or big fat question marks. They are having an energetic and very happy conversation, though it looks a bit forced, because to a man,
They are carrying long weapons out in plain sight. One of them has a hunting rifle, and each of the others is slinging a rudimentary-looking gun with a banana clip sticking out of the side. Randy thinks, but is not sure, that these are heap guns. This scene, not surprisingly, has caught the attention of the police, who have surrounded these four with squad cars, and who are standing at the ready with rifles and shotguns. It is an oddity of the law in many jurisdictions that, while carrying, say, a concealed one-shot 22 Derringer requires a license, openly carrying, for example, a big game rifle, is perfectly legal. Concealed weapons are outlawed, or at least heavily regulated, and unconcealed ones are not. So a lot of secret admirers, who tend to be gun nuts, have taken to going around conspicuously armed as a way of pointing out the absurdity of those rules. Their point is this. Who gives a shit about concealed weapons anyway, since they are only useful for defending oneself against assaults by petty criminals, which almost never happens? The real reason the Constitution provides for the right to bear arms is defending oneself against oppressive governments, and when it comes to that, your handgun is close to useless. So, according to these guys, if you are going to assert your right to keep and bear arms, you should do it openly, by packing something really big. A bunch of junk scrolls up Randy's screen. "Welcome to the Crypt," it begins. And then there's a paragraph of information about what a great idea the Crypt is and how anyone who gives a damn about privacy should get an account here. Randy truncates the commercial message with the whack of a key and logs in as Randy. Then he enters the command, telnettombstone.epiphyte.com, and gets two gratifying messages in return. One saying that a connection has been established with Tombstone, and the next saying that a swan link has been automatically negotiated. Finally, he gets Tombstone login, which means that he is now free to log on to the machine right across the street from him. And now Mr. Randy has a little decision to make. So far, he's clean. The bits coming out of his laptop are encrypted. So even if someone is monitoring the local packet radio net, all they know is that some encrypted bits are flying around. They cannot trace any of those bits to Randy's machine without bringing in an elaborate radio direction-finding rig and zeroing in on him most conspicuously. Those encrypted bits are eventually finding their way to laundry.org up in Oakland, which is a big internet host that probably has thousands of packets rushing in and out of it every second. If someone were tapping laundry.org's T3 line, which would require an enormous investment in computers and communications gear, they would detect a very small number of encrypted packets going out to crypt.kk in Kinakuta. But these packets would have been stripped of any identifying information before leaving laundry.org, and so there would be no way to tell where they originated. Now, crypt.kk is also an anonymizer, and so an entity tapping its staggeringly enormous T5 line, a job on the order of eavesdropping on a small country's telecommunications system, might theoretically be able to detect a few packets going back and forth between crypt.kk and Tombstone. But again, these would be stripped of identifying information, and so it would be impossible to trace them even as far back as laundry.org, to say nothing of tracing them all the way back to Randy's laptop. But in order for Randy to get into Tombstone and begin actually tampering with the evidence, he must now log on. If it were a poorly secured host of the type that used to be Legion on the Internet, he could just exploit one of its numerous security holes and crack his way into it, so that if his activities on the machine were discovered, he could claim that it wasn't him, just some cracker who happened to break into the machine at the very moment it was being seized by the cops. But Randy has spent the last several years of his life making machines such as this one impregnable to crackers, and he knows it's impossible. Furthermore, there's no point in logging on just as any old user, like using a guest account. Guests are not allowed to tamper with system files. In order to do any meaningful evidence tampering here, Randy has to log on as the super user. The name of the super user account is, inconveniently, Randy. And you can't actually log in as Randy without entering a password that only Randy would know.
So, after using the very latest in cryptographic technology and transoceanic packet-switching communications to conceal his identity, Randy now finds himself faced with the necessity of typing his name into the fucking machine. A little scenario flashes up in his head in which he sends an anonymous broadcast message to all Laundry.org users telling them that the password for the Randy account on tombstone.epiphyte.com is such and such, and urging them to spread this information all over the internet as fast as possible. This might have been a decent idea if he had thought of it an hour ago. Now it is too late. Any sentient prosecutor tracing the timestamps on the messages would be able to prove that it was just a blind. Besides, time is running low. The discussion across the street, which is just a shrill hubbub at this distance, is rising to some sort of climax. Randy has meanwhile booted up his browser and gone to the Ordo.net homepage. Usually it's a pretty dull corporate homepage, but today all of the blurbs and quotidian press releases have been obliterated by a window showing live color video of what is going on in front of the building, or rather what was going on a couple of seconds ago. Coming over his miserable low-bandwidth radio link, the video changes frames about once every 3 seconds. The video is originating from Ordo itself, where they've evidently aimed a camera out the window and are slamming the images straight out over their very own T3 line. Randy glances up just in time to see the guy who invented the term virtual reality walking across the lot, deep in conversation with the executive editor of Turing magazine. Not far behind them is Bruce, an operating systems engineer who in his spare time records Tierra del Fuego folk music and makes it available for free over the internet.
"Bruce!"
Randy shouts. Bruce falters and looks over in Randy's direction.
"Randy,"
he says.
"Why are you here?"
"Word on the street is that the feds were raiding Ordo," Bruce says.
"Interesting. Any particular feds?"
"Comstock,"
Bruce says, meaning Paul Comstock, who, by virtue of being Attorney General of the United States, runs the FBI. Randy does not believe this rumor, but in spite of himself, he scans the area for people fitting the general profile of FBI agents. The FBI hates and fears strong crypto. Meanwhile, another secret admirer type shouts,
"I heard Secret Service!"
Which is even creepier in a way because the Secret Service is part of the Treasury Department and is charged with combating wire fraud and protecting the nation's currency. Randy says,
"Would you be open to the possibility that it's all a net rumor? That what's really going on is that a piece of equipment inside Ordo's offices is being seized as part of a legal squabble?"
"Then why are all these cops here?" Bruce says.
"Maybe the masked men with assault rifles drew them."
"Well, why did the secret admirer show up in the first place if it wasn't a government raid?"
"I don't know. Maybe it's just some kind of spontaneous self-organizing phenomenon like the origin of life in the primordial soup."
Bruce says,
"Isn't it just as possible that the legal squabble is a pretext?"
"In other words, that the squabble is sort of like a Trojan horse put together by Comstock?"
"Yeah."
Knowing all of the parties involved, I'd rate it as unlikely,"
Randy says.
"But let me think about it."
The noise and intensity of the argument in the Ordo parking lot spike upwards. Randy looks at the video window, which unfortunately has no soundtrack. The transactions between frames come as isolated blocks of new pixels slapped up one at a time over the old, like a large billboard being posted in sections. High-definition TV, it ain't. But Randy definitely recognizes Avi, standing there, tall, pale, and calm, flanked by one guy who's probably Dave, the Ordo president, and another guy who's obviously a lawyer. They are literally standing in the doorway of the building and facing off against two cops and none other than Andrew Loeb, who is in rapid motion and hence poses an insurmountable bandwidth problem. The internet video gear is smart enough not to mess with parts of an image that aren't changing very much, and so the planted cops get refreshed maybe a couple of times a minute, and then just in a few rectangular image shards. But Andrew Loeb is waving his arms around, hopping up and down, lunging towards Avi from time to time, pulling back and taking calls on his cell phone, and waving documents in the air. The computers have identified him as a bunch of pixels that require a great deal of attention and bandwidth, and so somewhere some poor algorithm is churning through the high-pressure slurry of compressed pixels that is the image of Andrew Loeb, and doing its level best to freeze the most rapidly moving parts into discrete frames and chop them up into checkerboard squares that can be broadcast as packets over the net. These packets arrive in Randy's computer as the radio network passes them along, that is, sporadically and in the wrong order. So Andrew Loeb appears as a cubist digital video artifact, a rectilinear amoeba of mostly trenchcoat beige pixels. From time to time, his eyes or his mouth will suddenly appear, disembodied in the center of an image block, and remain frozen there for a few seconds, crystallized in a moment of howling rage. This is weirdly mesmerizing until Randy's startled out of his reverie by a clunk. He looks over to see that the van he's blocked in wasn't abandoned after all. It was full of dwarves, who have now thrown the back doors open to reveal a nest of cables and wires. A couple of the dwarves are heaving a boxy apparatus up onto the roof of the van. Cables run out of it to another boxy apparatus down below. The apparatus is electrical in nature and doesn't appear capable of firing projectiles, so Randy decides not to pay it much attention for the moment. Voices well up across the street. Randy sees some cops climbing out of a cop van carrying a battering ram. Randy types, "Randy," and hits the return key. Tombstone answers, "Password," and Randy types it in. Tombstone informs him that he's logged on and that he has mail. The fact that Randy's logged on has now been recorded by the system in several locations on the hard drive. He has, in other words, just slapped big, greasy fingerprints all over a weapon that the police are moments away from seizing as evidence. If Tombstone is shut down and grabbed by the cops before Randy can erase those traces, they will know he is logged on at the very moment that Tombstone was confiscated, and will put him in prison for tampering with evidence. He very much wishes that Douglas MacArthur Shafto could somehow be made aware of what a ballsy thing he is doing here. But then Doug has probably done all kinds of ballsy things of which Randy will never be aware, and Randy respects him anyway because of his bearing. Maybe the way to get that kind of bearing is to go around doing ballsy things in secret that somehow percolate up to the surface of your personality. Randy could just reformat the hard drive with a single command, but one, it would take several minutes to execute, and two, it would not thoroughly erase the incriminating bits, which could be lifted from the hard drive by a motivated technician. Because he knows which files have recorded his logon, he executes a command that finds those files on the hard drive. Then he types another command that causes random numbers to be written over those areas of the hard drive 7 times in a row. The cops are slamming the battering ram against the side door of the office building when Randy's right pinky slams the enter key and executes that command. He is almost certainly safe from the tampering with evidence charge now, but he hasn't actually tampered yet, which is the whole point of this exercise. He needs to find all the copies of the email message that specifies the latitude and longitude of the wreck, and do the same multiple erase trick on them. If the damn things were not encrypted, he could search for the critical strings of digits. As it is, he will have to search for files that were created during a certain time period, around the time that Randy was out on Glory, anchored over the wreck. Randy knows roughly what day that was, and so he sets the limits of the search to give him any files created 5 days either side of that, just to be safe, and limits it to only those directories used for email. The search takes forever. Or maybe it just seems that way because the cops have smashed the side door off its hinges now and are inside the building. The video window catches Randy's eye as it changes dramatically. He gets a veering montage of grainy frozen images of a room, a doorway, a hallway, a reception area, and finally a barricade. The Ordo guys have yanked their video camera out of the window and restationed it at their front desk, recording a barrier built of cheap modular office furniture piled against the glass entrance to the reception. The camera tilts up to show that one of the 4 glass door slabs has been already crystallized by, one supposes, the impact of the battering ram. Randy's find command finally returns with a list of about 100 files,
The half dozen or so critical ones are on the list somewhere, but Randy doesn't have time to go through the list, figuring out which is which. He has the system generate a list of the disk blocks occupied by those files, so that he can go back later and do a super erase. Once he's got that information, he does a RM, or remove, command on all of them. This is a paltry and miserable way to expunge secrets from a hard drive, but Randy's afraid he may not have time to do it more thoroughly. The RM only takes a few moments, and then Randy goes back and has the system write random numbers on top of those disk blocks 7 times in a row, just as he did earlier. By this time, the barricade has been scattered all over Ordo's lobby, and the cops are inside. They have weapons drawn and pointed at the ceiling, and they don't look very happy. There is one thing left to do. Actually, it's a pretty big thing. The Epiphyte people use Tombstone for all kinds of purposes, and there's no way of telling whether other copies of that latitude and longitude exist on it somewhere. Most of Epiphyte is made up of inveterate computer users who would be just the sort to write little scripts to back up all of their old email messages to an archive every week. So he whips up his own script that will just write random information to every sector on the entire hard drive, then go back and do it again and again and again. Forever. Or until the cops pull the plug. Just after he whacks the enter key to send his command into Tombstone, he hears an electrical buzzing noise from the van that makes his hair stand on end for a moment. He sees a cop in the video window, frozen. Then the screen of his computer goes blank. Randy looks over toward the old van. The dwarves are high-fiving each other. There is a screeching of tires and the sound of a low-speed collision out on the street. About a dozen cars have rolled quietly to a stop. Some have been rear-ended by others that are still functioning. The McDonald's has gone dark. Television technicians are cursing inside their mobile units. Police officers and lawyers are pounding their walkie-talkies and cell phones against their hands. Pardon me, Randy says to the dwarves, but would you gentlemen like to share anything with me?
We just took out the whole building, says one of the dwarves.
Took it out? In what sense?
Nailed it with a big electromagnetic pulse. Fried every chip within range.
So it's a scorched earth kind of deal. Go ahead and confiscate that gear, you damn feds. It's all worthless junk now.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly worked on those cars, Randy says. And it definitely worked on this piece of junk that used to be my computer.
Oh, don't worry. It has no effect on hard drives, the dwarf says. So all of your files are intact.
I know you are expecting me to take that as good news, Randy says.
Buddha. A car is coming. The engine noise is expensively muffled, but it sounds like a diesel. Goto Dango is awake, waiting for it, and so is the rest of the camp. No one stirs at Boondock during the day anymore, except for the radio men and those manning the anti-aircraft guns. They have not been told that MacArthur is on Luzon, but they all sense the general's presence. The American planes rip across the sky all day long, glittering and proud, like starships from a distant future that none of them will ever see, and the earth rings like a bell from the impacts of distant naval guns. The shipments have become smaller but more frequent. One or two broken-down lorries every night, their rear bumpers practically scraping the ground under crippling burdens of gold. Lieutenant Maury has placed another machine gun at the front gate, concealed in the foliage, just in case some Americans happen to blunder up this road in a jeep. Somewhere out there in the dark, the barrel of that weapon is tracking this car as it jounces up the road. The men know every dip and rise in that road and can tell where the vehicles are by listening for the scrape of their undercarriages against the hard pan, a signature pattern of metallic dots and dashes. The car's headlamps are off, of course, and the guards at the gate dare not shine bright lights around. One of them risks opening up a kerosene lantern and aims its beam at the visitor. A silver Mercedes hood ornament springs forth from the blackness, supported by a chrome-plated radiator grill. The beam of the lantern fondles the car's black fenders, its sweeping silver exhaust pipes, its running boards clotted with the meat of young coconuts. It must have sideswiped a pile on its way up here.
In the driver's side window is the face of a Nipponese man in his 40s, so haggard and tired he looks as though he is about to burst into tears. But he is just a driver. Next to him is a sergeant with a sawed-off shotgun, Nipponese rifles being generally too long to wield in the front seat of a luxury car. Behind them, a drawn curtain conceals whatever or whoever is in the back seat.
"Open!"
demands the guard, and the driver reaches up behind his head and parts the curtain. The lantern beam falls through the opening and bounces back sharply from a pale face in the back seat. Several of the soldiers shout. Goto Dengo steps back, rattled, then moves in for a closer look. The man in the back seat has a very large head, but the strange thing about him is that his skin is a rich yellow color, not the normal Asian yellow, and it glitters. He is wearing a peculiar pointed hat, and he has a calm smile on his face, an expression the likes of which Goto Dengo has not seen since the war began. More lantern beams come on. The ring of soldiers and officers closes in on the Mercedes. Someone pulls the rear door open and then jumps back as if he has burned his hand on it. The passenger is sitting cross-legged on the back seat, which has been crushed into a broad V beneath his weight. It is a solid gold Buddha, looted from somewhere else in the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, coming to meditate in serene darkness atop the horde of Golgotha. It turns out to be small enough to fit through the entrance, but too big to go in one of the little railway cars, and so the strongest Filipino men must spend the next hours shoving it down the tunnel, 1 inch at a time. The early shipments were neatly crated, and the crates were stenciled with labels identifying the contents as machine gun ammunition or mortar rounds or the like. The crates that come later don't have the stencils. At a certain point, the gold begins to arrive in cardboard boxes and rotten steamer trunks. They fall open all the time, and the workers patiently gather the gold up and carry it to the tunnel entrance in their arms and throw it into the handcars. The bars tumble end over end and smash into the sheet metal with a din that scares clouds of birds out of the overhanging trees. Goto Dengo cannot help looking at the bars. They come in different sizes, some of them so large that it takes two men to carry one. They are stamped with the names of central banks from a few places Goto Dengo has been, and many he's only heard of. Singapore, Saigon, Batavia, Manila, Rangoon, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Canton. There is French gold that was apparently shipped to Cambodia, and Dutch gold shipped to Jakarta, and British gold shipped to Singapore, all to keep it out of the hands of the Germans. But some shipments consist entirely of gold from the Bank of Tokyo. They get 5 convoys in a row of the stuff. According to the tally that Goto Dengo is keeping in his head, 2/3 of the tonnage stored in Golgotha ends up coming straight from Nippon's central reserves. All of it is cold to the touch and stored in good but old crates. He concludes that it was shipped to the Philippines a long time ago and has been sitting in a cellar in Manila ever since, waiting for this moment. They must have shipped it here at about the same time that Goto Dengo was plucked off the beach in New Guinea, way back in late 1943. They have known. They have known for that long that they were going to lose the war. By the middle of January, Goto Dengo has begun to look back on the Christmas Day massacre with something almost like nostalgia, missing the atmosphere of naive innocence that made the killings necessary. Until that morning, even he had managed to convince himself that Golgotha was an arms cache that the Emperor's soldiers would someday use to stage a glorious reconquest of Luzon. He knows that the workers believed it too. Now everyone knows about the gold, and the camp has changed. Everyone understands that there will be no exit. At the beginning of January, the workers are made up of 2 types, those who are resigned to die here and those who aren't. The latter group make various escape attempts of a desultory and hopeless nature and are shot by the guards. The era of hoarding ammunition seems to be over, or perhaps the guards are just too sick and hungry to climb down out of the watchtowers and personally bayonet all of the people who present themselves to be killed.
So it is all done with bullets, and the bodies left to balloon and blacken. Boondock is imminent with their stench. Gododengo hardly notices, though, because the camp is suffused with the crazy sick tension that always precedes a battle. Or so he supposes. He has seen a lot of excitement in this war, but he has never been in a proper battle. The same is automatically true of most of the Nipponese here, because essentially all of the Nipponese who go into battles wind up dead. In this army, you are either a greenhorn or a corpse. Sometimes a briefcase arrives along with the gold shipment. The briefcase is always handcuffed to the wrist of a soldier who has grenades dangling all over his body so that he can blow himself and it to powder if the convoy should be assaulted by hooks. The briefcases go straight to the Boondock radio station, and their contents are placed in a safe. Gododengo knows that they must contain codes. Not the usual books, but some kind of special codes that are changed every day, because every morning after the sun has come up, the radio officer performs a ceremony of burning a single sheet of paper in front of the transmitter shack, and then rubbing the withered leaf of ash between his hands. It is through that radio station that they will receive the final order. All is in readiness, and Gododengo goes through the complex once a day, checking everything. The diagonal tunnel finally reached the stub tunnel at the bottom of Lake Yamamoto a couple of weeks ago. The stub was filled with water that had seeped past the concrete plug during the months since it had been put into place, and so when the two tunnels were finally joined, several tons of water ran down the diagonal into Golgotha. This was expected and planned for. All of it went into a sump and drained from there into the Tojo River. Now it is possible to go all the way up the diagonal and look at the concrete plug from the underside. Lake Yamamoto is on the other side. Gododengo goes up there every couple of days, ostensibly to check the plug and its demolition charges, but really to check on the progress being made, unbeknownst to Captain Noda, by Wings and Rodolfo's crews. They are mostly drilling upwards, making more of those short vertical dead-end shafts, and enlarging the chambers at their tops. The system, including the new ventilation shafts ordered by the general and dug from the top down just to the east of the ridgeline, looks very different from the original blueprints. Inside the primary storage complex is a small room that Captain Noda has dubbed the Hall of Glory. It does not look very glorious right now. Most of it is filled with a snarl of wires which have been run into it from all parts of the Golgotha complex, and which dangle from the ceiling or trail on the floor with hand-lettered paper tags dangling from them, saying things like, "Main entrance demolition charges." There are several crates of lead-acid batteries to supply power for the detonations, and to give Gododengo a few minutes of electric light by which to read these paper tags. Extra boxes of dynamite and blasting caps are stacked at one end of the Hall of Glory in case some tunnels need a little extra destruction, and coils of red fuse cord in case the electrical system fails completely. But the demolition order hasn't yet come, so Gododengo does the things soldiers do while waiting to die. He writes letters to his family that will never be delivered or even mailed. He smokes. He plays cards. He goes and checks his equipment another time, and then another. A week goes by without any gold deliveries. 20 prisoners try to escape together. The ones who don't get sprayed across the killing ground by mines get tangled in barbed wire and are each shot by a team of two guards, one aiming a flashlight and the other aiming a rifle. Captain Noda spends all night, every night, pacing back and forth in front of the main gate and smoking cigarettes, then drinks himself to sleep at dawn. The radio men sit in front of their rig, watching the tubes glow, jerking like electrified frog legs whenever a feeble string of beeps comes in on their frequency. But the order does not come. One night, then, the trucks come again, just as they did the first time. The convoy must contain all that's left of the Nipponese motor pool on Luzon. They all come together, making a rumble that can be heard half an hour before they actually reach the gate. When their cargo has been taken out and stacked on the ground, the soldiers guarding this convoy remain behind at Boondock. The only people who leave are the drivers. It takes 2 days to move this last horde into the tunnels.
One of their shuttle trucks has broken down for good and been cannibalized to keep the other one going. It is running on half of its cylinders and is so feeble that it has to be pushed up the riverbed road by teams of workers and hauled over the rough patches on ropes. It has finally begun to rain, and the Tojo River is rising. The main vault is nearly full of treasure, and so is the Fool's Vault. The new shipment has to be packed in wherever it will fit. They break it out of its crates and jam it into crannies. The crates are stenciled with double-headed eagles and swastikas, and the gold bars inside come from Berlin, Vienna, Warsaw, Prague, Paris, Amsterdam, Riga, Copenhagen, Budapest, Bucharest, Milan. There are also cardboard boxes filled with diamonds. Some of the crates are still damp and smell of the sea. Seeing this, Gutto Dango knows that a big submarine must have arrived from Germany, filled with Nazi treasure. So that explains the two-week lull. They've been waiting the arrival of this U-boat. He works in the tunnels for 2 days, wearing a miner's headlamp, shoving jewels and gold bars into crevices. He goes into a sort of trance that is finally interrupted by a heavy thud reverberating through the rock. Artillery, he thinks, or a bomb from one of MacArthur's planes. He comes up the main ventilation shaft to the top of the ridge where it's broad daylight. He is crushed to discover that there is no battle underway. MacArthur isn't going to rescue him. Lieutenant Maury has brought almost all of the workers up here, and they are hauling on ropes, dragging Boondock's heavy equipment up and throwing it down into the recently dug ventilation shafts. Both of the trucks are up here, and men with torches and sledgehammers are breaking them up into pieces small enough to drop down the shafts. Gutto Dango arrives just in time to see the engine block of the radio station's generator tumbling down a shaft into blackness. The rest of the radio gear follows it directly. Somewhere nearby, concealed in the trees, someone is grunting heavily, doing some kind of hard physical labor. It is a practiced martial arts type of grunt, from way down in the diaphragm.
"Lieutenant Gutto," says Captain Noda.
He is daft with alcohol.
"Your duties are below." "What was that loud noise?"
Noda beckons him over to an outcropping from which they can see down into the valley of the Tojo River. Gutto Dango, unsteady for any number of reasons, suffers a spell of dizziness and nearly falls off. The problem is disorientation. He does not recognize the river. Until now, it has always been a few trickles of water braided down a rocky bed. Even before they ran a road up to it, you could get up almost as far as the waterfall by hopping from one dry rock to the next. Now, all of a sudden, the river is wide, deep, and murky. The tips of a few big rocks protrude from the surface here and there. He remembers something he saw 100 years ago in a previous incarnation on another planet, a bedsheet from the Manila Hotel with a crude map sketched on it. The Tojo River drawn in with a fat trail of blue fountain pen ink.
"We dynamited the rockfall," Noda says, "according to the plan."
Long ago, they had poised rocks above a bottleneck in the river, ready to create a little dam. But setting off that dynamite was supposed to be almost the last thing they did before sealing themselves up inside.
"But we are not ready,"
Gutto Dango says. Noda laughs. He seems quite high-spirited.
"You have been telling me for a month that you are ready."
"Yes,"
Lieutenant Gutto says, slowly and thickly.
"You are right. We are ready."
Noda slaps him on the back.
"You must get to the main entrance before it floods."
"My crew."
"Your crew is waiting for you there."
Gutto Dango begins walking towards the trail that will take him down to the main entrance. Along the way, he passes the top of another ventilation shaft. Several dozen workers are queued up there, thumbs lashed together behind their backs with piano wire, guarded by soldiers with fixed bayonets. One by one, prisoners kneel at the lip of the shaft. Lieutenant Maury whips his officer sword into the nape of each neck with a terrific grunt. Head and body tumble forward into the ventilation shafts and thud meatily into other bodies far below, a couple of seconds later. Every leaf and pebble within a 3-meter radius of the shaft opening is saturated with bright red blood, and so is Lieutenant Maury.
"Don't worry about that," Captain Noda says. "I will see to it that the tops of the shafts are backfilled with rubble, as we discussed. The jungle will grow over them long before the Americans ever find this place."
Goto Dengo averts his eyes and turns to leave.
"Lieutenant Goto,"
says a voice. He turns around. It is Lieutenant Maury, pausing for a moment to catch his breath. A Filipino kneels before him, mumbling a prayer in Latin, fumbling with a rosary that dangles from his bound hands.
"Yes, Lieutenant Maury."
"According to my roster, 6 prisoners are signed out to you. I will need them."
"Those 6 prisoners are down below, helping to load in the last shipment."
"But all of the shipment is inside the tunnels now."
"Yes, but not well placed. The entire purpose of the Fool's Vault is ruined if we strew gold and diamonds around the place in such a way as to lead thieves deeper into the caverns. I need these men to continue that work."
"You take full responsibility for them?"
"I do,"
Goto Dengo says.
"If there are only 6, Captain Noda says, "then your crew should be able to keep them under control."
"I will see you at Yasukuni, Goto Dengo,"
says Lieutenant Maury.
"I will look forward to it,"
Goto Dengo says. He does not add that Yasukuni must be a very crowded place by now, and they will probably have a terrible time finding each other.
"I envy you. The end will be longer and harder for those of us on the outside."
Lieutenant Maury snaps his blade into the back of the Filipino's head, cutting him off between an Ave and a Maria.
"Your heroism will not go unrewarded," Goto Dengo says.
Lieutenant Maury's crew awaits him down below, in front of the mouse hole that leads into Golgotha. 4 hand-picked soldiers. Each wears a 1,000-stitch headband, and so each has an orange ball centered on his forehead, reminding Goto Dengo not of the rising sun, but of an exit wound. The water is up to mid-thigh now, and the entrance tunnel is half full. When Goto Dengo arrives, followed closely by Captain Noda, the men all cheer him politely. Goto Dengo squats in the opening. Only his head and shoulders are above the water. Before him, the tunnel is black. It takes a powerful effort of will for him to enter, but it is no worse than what he used to do in the abandoned mines back in Hokkaido. Of course, the abandoned mines weren't going to be dynamited shut behind him. Going forward is his chance to survive. If he hesitates, Noda will kill him on the spot and all his crew, and others will be sent in to finish the job. Noda made sure that others were trained to do it.
"See you at Yasukuni,"
he says to Captain Noda, and without waiting for a response, he sloshes forward into blackness.